Thanks for coming to the Sydney Institute tonight. Tonight's speaker is Wajih Ahmed. I'll introduce her briefly. She studied law and communications at the University of Western Sydney and is currently doing a master's in law at Sydney University. She's a practicing solicitor, a community relations commissioner, and sits on a number of boards on behalf of the Community Relations Commission. She's also a part-time lecturer in business law and ethics at InSearch UTS and a former general secretary of the Pakistan Association. And tonight, Ms. Ahmed's talking on Pakistan, the current political scene. Many thanks.
Thank you. Thank you to Gerard and members of the Sydney Institute for asking me to speak today. I hope that I can provide you some insight into this topic, but I will put a huge caveat and say just with events in the last 1 week means that my topic may be completely defunct tomorrow. To begin with, I would also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, upon whose land we meet tonight. I'd also like to thank my friends, family and members of the media for attending tonight. Most importantly, I would like to thank my family, and in particular my parents, who I'm proud to say who are here tonight. Let me begin by stating on the outset that, as I said, I hope to provide a snapshot of the current political scene in Pakistan. As you all know, I was born in Pakistan but have been brought up in Australia. Earlier this year, on my most recent visit to Pakistan, I arrived in Lahore, and typically there were a number of gentlemen standing with signs to collect the VIP, or as we like to call them, the VVIPs, as we all descended the escalator in Lahore. I took no notice and lined up in the women family section, travelling alone as I usually do in Pakistan. While standing in line for about 15 minutes, one of the VVIP holding guys was walking around asking the girls, "Are you Wajih Omar?" whilst holding the sign in Urdu. When he got to me and asked me, I of course said no, thought nothing of it, and got my luggage and visited my family outside. My family asked me when I got outside if I'd received any special treatment. I said the customs guy was asking why I was carrying so much luggage arriving into Pakistan, but apart from that, no other special treatment. My family laughed and went on to say that your aunt had arranged for you to be collected and fast-tracked. And I said no one had approached me. My aunt, Mrs. Amna Umar, had in fact called in the request as a surprise, and the guy who wrote down the message assumed her niece would also be called Wajih Omar, and even if she wasn't, she'd at least be able to read Urdu. Both assumptions were of course incorrect. Maybe if he'd been holding a meat pie, I would have gotten the idea. As Gerard has mentioned, that I've been working as a lawyer here in Sydney for more than 5 years now. Majority of the work that I've been involved in has involved the Pakistani community, whether it's been from a client perspective or cross-jurisdictional issues. Being in Australia for the last 27 years has meant that my version of the way that I see Pakistan has been through these interactions, more particularly while I've been a lawyer. I guess one of the areas which has certainly been a highlight has been working with the Advocate General of Punjab in a very complicated wills and probate matter. And my community work as a former General Secretary of the Pakistan Association as well has given me an idea of the Pakistani community living here in Australia, but a greater understanding of my own culture back in Pakistan. I'd like to begin by introducing some of my family members. Now, why, you would ask? Because they are going to relate to the story that we're going to be discussing this evening. This is the first person that I'd like to introduce you to, Dr. Amna Bhutto. She's praised for her work with human rights by Condoleezza Rice in Congress, particularly working in the Mukhtar Mai case. Dr. Bhutto has also been elected as a member of the Provincial Assembly in Punjab in the most recent elections. Justice Bhutto. Both Dr. Amna Bhutto and Justice Bhutto are my father's brother and sister. Justice Bhutto was one of the first judges who allowed the provisional constitutional order by President Musharraf last year and was reinstated to the bench. I will come back to that later on. I'm sorry about the quality of this picture. This is Sardar Kamil Umar, who was also involved in BCCI, and his late grandmother was India's longest-serving female parliamentarian in Lucknow for over 40 years. Last but not least, the man who filed the habeas corpus petition and later the bail application for the late Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, my father, Pervez Bhutto, joins us here tonight. Now that, being a lawyer, I've gotten my caveats and disclaimers out of the way, let's get down to business. What I'd like to begin with is to point out to you what Pakistan actually looks like. Pakistan, I don't know if the people at the back can actually make out, but is divided into four distinct provinces. Up the top there, the orange part, is that okay if I come across? Yeah. This part is the state of Punjab in Pakistan. Down here you have the Sindh province. This side is Balochistan. And up the top is a frontier province. This area, which I've got on the next map, is the federal controlled territory, federally administered tribal areas, FATA, which I'll also be going through. But as you can see, this is the edge of the frontier province, and these are the areas that are certainly quite controversial. Pakistan became an independent nation on the 14th of August 1947. The current president of Pakistan is General Pervez Musharraf. The prime minister is Mr. Raza Gilani. And Pakistan, as I've stated, is divided into four provinces. But in particular, I want you to be aware of the FATA area. Most of you would be aware of the Azad Kashmir and northern areas, which are presently disputed territory. Can we just go back one? Thank you. Which is this section up here. They have their own respective political and administrative bodies. The federal government has a Ministry of Kashmir Affairs and Northern Areas in Pakistan. Similar to Australia, there are state parliaments and in more recent times the creation of the Nazim, which is the district-based bodies. In Pakistan, the president is elected by the members of the parliament, the National Assembly and the Senate, as well as those from the four provincial assemblies. The major religion in Pakistan is Islam, with other minority religions as well. The official language is English, and the state language is Urdu. The annual per capita income is approximately $846 per annum. The GDP is 8.4%. The major export is cotton and textiles, which makes up about 25% of the industry. Information varies and notes literacy between 46 to 53%. The form of parliament is similar to the Australian system, with the two houses of Senate and National Assembly, the lower house. The National Assembly has 342 members elected, with 272 general seats, 60 seats for women, and 10 non-Muslim seats. The Senate has 100 seats. Pakistan follows the British system in relation to the system of law, with the practice of the common law. Its constitution encompasses all parts of the law, including but not limited to welfare, taxation and governance. Now, this brings us to the events of the last 1 year. Thank you. I'd like, if it's okay, to talk to you about the different events, not so much scripted as to go through with them. And if it's okay with my hosts, if people would like to be interactive at this point, because some of these issues may spark up discussion, is that okay?
I prefer it at the end.
Prefer it at the end? Yeah. Okay, we'll stick to that. Okay. So in March of 2007, last year, the Pakistani president, General Pervez Musharraf, suspends the head of the Supreme Court, Mr. Iftikhar Muhammad Chaudhry, for alleged misconduct. Musharraf's popularity starts to decline. Lawyers start rallying against this, and a suicide bomber kills 16 people and injures at least 63 at a lawyer's rally in Islamabad. In July, Pakistan's top court reinstates His Honour as a court's Chief Justice, declaring Musharraf's decision to suspend him illegal. By September, It's alleged that Musharraf will step down as the head of the military. The Supreme Court begins to hear petitions seeking to block Musharraf's plans for a second presidential term. The Election Commission announces a vote for the presidency, which will be held on October 6th when Musharraf will seek re-election. Riot police arrest dozens of opposition activists protesting against Musharraf as the Supreme Court dismisses two challenges to his bid for re-election. President Musharraf files nomination papers for a second five-year term at that point in time. His Honour Chaudhry orders the release of hundreds of opposition activists who had been rounded up by police during this process. By the end of September, the Supreme Court throws out the major legal challenge to Musharraf standing for election to shouts of shame from lawyers in the courtroom. I guess at this point in time, it's worthwhile to have a chat about that, which is that a constitutional application had been made to the Supreme Court in Pakistan, challenging the constitutional validity of President Musharraf being able to stand for a further term. Unfortunately, some of the judges weren't agreeable, and therefore the application was successful. But this obviously has questions about whether or not there is an actual separation of powers between judiciary and the legislative bodies in Pakistan. By October, more than 80 Pakistani opposition politicians resign in protest at Musharraf's attempt to be re-elected. It's also announced that General Ashfaq Kiani will take over as the head of the army after the election. President Musharraf, by October 6, sweeps to victory in the presidential elections, winning 252 of the 257 votes cast in parliament and prevailing in all four provinces, thanks to a boycott by opposition parties. But he faces legal challenges in the Supreme Court. Once again, there could be questions raised about whether or not the legislative and the government are actually separate. Issues with respect to the Red Mosque. I'm going to assume that most people are aware of the situation with the Red Mosque, but if I'm going to gloss over things too quickly, please do let me know and I'll go into them a bit more in more detail. The issue surrounding the Red Mosque crisis, I guess we can call it, was relating to pro-Taliban militants at the Red Mosque, and four police officers were taken hostage, particularly being accused as spies for the government. As a result, their reaction sparked off a number of riots and a number of other hostages being taken, including some poor Chinese residents who were running a massage parlour and were accused of running a brothel. Students were involved, members from different religious organisations were involved, and the situation in particular became quite turbulent because certain members of extremist groups felt that this was the government interfering and intervening in a religious matter. Up until this point in time, the Musharraf government had certainly been working very closely and also working to try to achieve a result which would acknowledge the concerns of the extremist groups, but also to ensure that there was no inflammation with riots or other security issues. By the end of this standoff, the army actually goes into the mosque, which by the religious standards meant not just offence, but it meant that they no longer had jurisdiction to run their own, I guess you could call it, court. This leads on to the state of emergency situation, which occurs in November. So the whole mosque situation sort of finishes in July, but this leads us into November, where Commonwealth foreign ministers threaten to expel Pakistan from their group if President Musharraf fails to repeal the state of emergency, which he calls, as a result of the constitutional order that he had requested for him to be able to be elected as a further president of Pakistan. Under the current constitution, the president-elect may only be able to serve two terms. Some may say that the appointment originally by President Musharraf, by changing the constitution to allow him to be elected, was perhaps not a democratic process anyway, let alone allowing him to be elected for a third time. At that point in time, the United States also opposed the emergency rule that takes place. Certain rumours start as well to suggest that Musharraf is about to suspend the constitution, which he does. At this point in time, the judges and certain lawyers are arrested, television and radio stations are taken off the air, and the Chief Justice is sacked. More than 350 lawyers are arrested in these protests, in protest to this particular event. President Musharraf is forced to deny that he's under house arrest as rumours start to circle of a coup. Elections are called in the beginning of November for elections to be held by the 15th of February. New judges are appointed to the Supreme Court to strike down the challenges against the re-election, which allow the provisional constitutional order to go ahead. The Supreme Court dismisses this last legal challenge to Musharraf's re-election, and the Commonwealth suspends Pakistan for the second time in 8 years. Musharraf resigns as the head of the army at a ceremony in Rawalpindi in order to show his, I guess, allegiance to governance over the power play. Musharraf is therefore, 1 day later, sworn in as president for a second 5-year term and promises to lift emergency rule by December 16. Lawyers are opposed to this course of action and riot in Lahore. The power struggle begins with the president and his hopeful successors. The two successors, which I'm sure you're aware of, or proposed successors, being the now late Benazir Bhutto and also Nawaz Sharif. When Bhutto decides to come back to Pakistan to stand for re-election after, of course, you all know, being Prime Minister twice before in Pakistan, President, I beg your pardon, in Pakistan twice before, she's told that her personal security cannot be guaranteed. She's made aware that there are threats on her life, but despite that, the role of democracy with her father's background in starting the PPP is overriding, and she comes back. The day that she arrives back, things in Pakistan become quite turbulent. So a suicide bombing goes off during her homecoming procession in Karachi. The second event that also occurs is the now defunct leader of the PMLN, Nawaz Sharif, also decides to return for election in the February election. After many attempts of coming back to Pakistan as he'd been exiled, his application is accepted and is able to come back to Pakistan after 7 years. Bhutto files for nomination papers at the same time as when he arrives, and also, as does Nawaz Sharif, registers for the election. A few days later, Pakistan's Electoral Commission bans Nawaz Sharif from taking part in the elections because of his criminal record. While this is all taking place, Musharraf announces that he will lift emergency rule by December 15th, which was a day earlier than expected. Nawaz Sharif says his party will participate in the elections after failing to secure unanimous support for a boycott. December 15 comes and the emergency rule has been ended. December 21, more than 50 people are killed as a suicide bomber detonates a bomb at a mosque 20 miles from Peshawar, near the home of a former interior minister, Aftab Khan Sherpao. Which leads on to December 27. Tragic event where Bhutto and at least 20 of his supporters are killed after an attacker fires shots at the former Prime Minister and then blows himself up at a Pakistan People's Party campaign in Pindi. The assassination sparks violence across the country. December 28, huge crowds of mourners gather for her funeral and she's buried beside her father in her hometown. Her will reveals that she would like the PPP to be led by her son. Both Bhutto's party and the PPP and Nawaz Sharif's party, PMLN, decide to contest the January 8th polls. With respect to security, With respect to security, as I've mentioned, the vast number of bombings and suicide bombers in particular increased during this period. Unlike our elections in Australia, in Pakistan, people take elections very, very seriously. It's a personal attack if your party has sledging or has some sort of approach to them. Okay, so there are a number of very high-flying, adrenaline-based reactions that take place. We think just the little scandal of one of our politicians standing in election who is caught talking to a journalist is a big deal. It's actually not like that at all. Tribal leaders at this point in time as well start to become quite nervous with the oncoming approach, with the successes being very much connected to the West, and don't feel comfortable that they are going to be properly represented, as a lot of them are not even happy with some of the reforms already taken by Musharraf during his current term. Al-Qaeda also make an approach whereby Osama bin Laden suggests that followers of the Taliban should rise up against not just the government, but the people in the election, as they're going against the word of God. By January 21, Musharraf lifts a ban on Pakistan's most popular television station, Geo News, and its sister sports channel. The Pakistani army, by January 25, launches an assault on the mountain stronghold of Mesud. By February, the Pakistani Taliban, at a meeting chaired by Mossad, declares a ceasefire after covert talks between militants, government officials and tribal elders. Pakistani investigators claim a breakthrough and say they have arrested two more very important suspects with ties to Mesud. February 18, Pakistan holds parliamentary elections. The turnout is low amid fears of violence. By February 19, the results are starting to come in as Musharraf's ruling party concedes defeat. The two opposition parties win 139 seats, more than half of the 272-seat National Assembly. The pro-Musharraf Muslim League Q party, PMLQ, wins 33 seats, and a series of party stalwarts and former cabinet ministers lose their seats. So what's happening now? I think we can go... With the coalition government, which has been elected. Parliament has not been sitting since the election. The coalition is unable to agree on the major issues which the government is required to make decisions on. The most frightening part is that there hasn't been an election of the leaders of the two coalition parties, but self-appointed leaders, Nawaz Sharif and Asif Zardari, the husband of the late Benazir Bhutto, have assumed those positions. Nawaz Sharif is said to be between London and Dubai, and Asif Zardari is said to be between Dubai and the United States. Neither of them have gone back to Pakistan since the elections. The judges have not been reinstated, and the proposed constitutional changes of both parties with respect to their reinstatement has also not occurred, even though this was a very large promise made at the outset by both parties. I guess if they're not even agreeing on how to run government, they can't even agree on how to get their judges back to creating the separation of powers. It is economically disruptive to run a government like this, with inflation rising, with forecasts predicted at 11.8% in the next financial year. Further security issues have been raised with the ceasefire, which only took place as of Friday last week, and the bombing of six people in the Fatah region, with particular six civilians who have been affected by a US bombing that's taken place in the frontier province as of Friday as well. The Prime Minister Gilani met with President George Bush yesterday to discuss both these issues, with the outcome that Pakistan's democratic sovereignty will be respected. However, the issue of security is still a big question mark. Pakistan has also signed certain counter-terrorism treaties with the United Nations, and if they stop their ceasefire, they may be in contravention of that particular treaty. Morale with respect to Pakistan is also being affected, with industry being on strike for the last 1 week as load shedding, whereby more than 12 hours worth of electricity is not running per day. The cotton and textile industry is being the most affected, as they're unable to do their work. The workers are on strike, with 25% of the industry being so heavily required to run the economy. This means that there is certainly going to be even more economical issues. Not to mention the obvious issues surrounding the world economics in terms of currency, in terms of trade, and certainly in terms of the current American markets. The same effect is taking place on the Pakistani stock exchange as well. We've gone into predictions. Good. I certainly predict that there may be more morale and civil unrest that may take place before the end of the year, before even when Parliament will sit. I further predict that it may well be that one party may decide to take over from the other, with or without being democratically elected. As I've mentioned, economically, industry will suffer without governance. And it may well be, there are some small rumblings that people are asking for President Musharraf to come back, because no matter what, during his time in Parliament, there was always a lot of economic and also social and political stability. In his presidential address to the Constituent Assembly on the 11th of August 1947, Qaid Azam Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, said, "Dealing with our first function in this assembly, I cannot make any well-considered pronouncement at this moment, but I will say a few things as they occur to me. The first and foremost thing that I would like to emphasise is this. Remember that you are now a sovereign legislative body, and you have got all the powers. It therefore places you on the gravest responsibility as to how you should take your decisions. The first observation that I would like to make is this. You will no doubt agree with me that the first duty of a government is to maintain law and order so that the life, property and religious beliefs of its subjects are fully protected by the state. With the vision of the founder of Pakistan, it is indeed important to remember that governance, separation of powers, and overall morale of 145 million people in a country the size of Victoria is going to be a difficult task. How it is achieved with the current state of affairs, not just in Pakistan, but also taking into consideration her neighbours and world economic and security trends, is a big job. My four main points are what I believe Pakistan needs to focus on in order to become an even more successful and sovereign nation. How they will achieve that, we'll have to wait and see. I'd like to finish my talk with one main point, which is that even though, as a lawyer, the rule of law and democracy is what I believe in being paramount, it is important to note that there have been no allegations of, nor has there ever been, any against President Musharraf of corruption. That he has led Pakistan through some difficult times, especially post 11th of September 2001. He has allowed the freedom of press, somewhat to his own detriment at times, and has certainly provided Pakistan with a longevity of stability over former leaders. I do not for a moment take back my belief in the rule of law, but I certainly would suggest that in a place like Pakistan, our fundamental Western beliefs may not be the right approach to ensuring the dream of the founder of Pakistan. I'd also like to dedicate this talk to a mentor, a friend and a respected member of our community here in Sydney, the late Major General Ehsanul Haq Malik, who lived and died a proud Pakistani in Australia. Thank you for your time, and I hope you gain some insight into my Pakistan.
Many thanks. So we come to questions and discussion. And we'll finish no later than 7 o'clock. That was very informative. Can I, someone who doesn't know a lot about Pakistan, what's, as you know, you've had periods of military rule in Pakistan, and yet there's a viable legal system, and as you're pointing out tonight, many lawyers are very vocal in politics. So what is the relationship between the government and the judiciary and the legal system, and why is it that of all the nations that have got some democratic forms, it seems to be the lawyers seem to be most vocal and in a practical way or in a demonstrative way in Pakistan. Have you just talked to the back of the room?
Certainly. I guess I'm going to be very biased in my approach because you can tell that vast majority of my family are already lawyers, and I actually failed to mention that my grandfather was also a lawyer and one of the lawyers who represented the late Zulfikar Ali Bhutto as well. Lawyers, I guess, have been entrenched in a long-standing tradition of social justice, not just in Pakistan but throughout the world. And if you have a look at even Pakistan and India's history at partition, all three major leaders at the time, Nehru, Gandhi and Jinnah, were all lawyers. So I guess it is certainly part and parcel of the way that we've all been brought up as lawyers to have this inbred social justice within us. The rule of law, the way that we've all been taught, as well as I've mentioned, has been with the background from the British and looking at the background of Amnesty and its origins and similar organisations. I think we've all been taught that way.
Okay, so there's a question here.
The ISI, yes. Is it the sinister organisation we read about? Who, if anybody, controls it? And is it pro-Taliban, or at least anti-America?
Really interesting question. Since I'm on the record, I would prefer not to answer that question. And instead, I would diplomatically like to say that when you have a developing nation, that there are many both government and non-government organisations which may be seen as sinister. So I'm purposely not going to answer that question, I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
How is Pakistan handling the whole issue of large numbers of Afghan refugees? I mean, Australia has a problem coping with a boatload of them, and Pakistan has so many, and I know some of those who've had really, really good educations while they've been in Pakistan and returned to Afghanistan. It seems to me an amazing achievement amidst all this chaos you're talking about.
Absolutely. Pakistan, I think according to the United Nations Human Rights Committee statistics, is either the first or the second largest, borderless country that has more than a million refugees categorised under the Asylum Seekers Conventions. And to be quite honest, without the support of a lot of NGOs, I don't think they would be able to help a lot of the Afghani refugees in Pakistan. I mean, they're having obviously difficulty being able to, even after the earthquake in 2005, to be able to repopulate and stabilise and create sustainable development projects for people in the north of Pakistan. So it's just as much of a problem with the Afghani refugees as well.
So are some of those towns really run by Afghans? I mean, the ones that have the largest population of Afghan refugees, are they really got a parallel system operating, or is it a Pakistani system that's operating there?
So are you talking about the Fatah region, or are you
possibly, I'm not sure, I'm not wise enough in the actual geography,
right.
But the biggest towns where the Afghan refugees are settled in Pakistan seem to have a full-scale education system that takes people through to university level.
I'm not quite following whether we're talking in Afghanistan or we're talking...
Well, I don't know. Is it Afghanistan or is it Pakistan? I guess that's the point. I mean, I understand some of those towns are in dispute.
In Pakistan, the refugees that end up coming to Pakistan, they obviously start to look for employment and end up in a lot of the big cities. So if we're talking about those sorts of refugees that are categorised as refugees, then they're actually living in the big cities and they're following the rule of law and they're following the traditions of Pakistan. If you're talking about the disputed territory and the issues surrounding those disputed territories, then that's, big question marks in terms of what's actually taking place, because it's the border with Afghanistan is certainly, a chalk line at the moment, because of what's taking place in that region. So I don't know if that kind of answers your question.
There's a question here.
While India seems to be powering onto the 21st century, Pakistan still remains a deeply religious country. A country like Pakistan always seems to be involved in religious problems and, tribal conflicts. I mean, what is the difference? Why can't they get together?
About the difference between religious attitudes in Pakistan and in India.
Yeah, really great question. If you can tell me the answer, I'm sure I could make $1 million. I think one of the things with India is that India is one of the largest multicultural nations in the world, and I think that that's to its credit, absolutely. India has one of the largest Islamic populations in the world, and because of the fact that it is a multicultural nation, they've had to get along a lot better. I think in some situations, and maybe Pakistan is one of those situations where the monoculture has created more infighting, but at the same time, we've also got two borders whereby we've got nations that are a little bit unstable, and that's causing Pakistan issues. But fingers crossed.
We've got plenty of time. There's a question here. Yeah.
Regarding the federally administered tribal areas, is it? You made one remark about if Pakistan should try to impose stronger security on those areas, they might be in breach of the UN guide. That's
one
question. And then the other part of the question is, what is the prospect for getting some kind of control, or for extending, let's call it, a sense of order within the Fatah?
Under President Musharraf, there has been order in Fatah, whereby he has had a zero-tolerance policy with respect to extremism. Despite that, some of the leaders have gone against that and done whatever they wanted, with not just bombings in the regional areas, but also within the urban areas as well. But that has meant that it's been on a no-negotiation basis, and the pressure by the army in that region has meant that there's been some checks and balances in place. If the army is removed, and also if the current state of what the coalition is suggesting, whereby they want to continue negotiations, or they want to start negotiations instead of doing the zero tolerance policy, this may mean that those checks and balances may not actually continue. The current United Nations treaty that Pakistan has actually signed is about counter-terrorism and ensuring that Pakistan will abide by that. In my opinion, I don't believe by sitting down to negotiate with people who have got such extremist views, that's going to be able to be achieved.
So that's zero tolerance of violence.
That's right. That's right. Okay. That's right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so we've got a question here and then we go down the back. Yep.
You mentioned some economic statistics. Why do you think the Pakistan economy has performed so badly relative to many other Asian economies? One thinks of Vietnam, which used to be much poorer than Pakistan is now richer and has had no rule of law and communist government and war, civil war and a war with China, but it's overtaken Pakistan. Why is this?
Absolutely, great question. I think September 11 has definitely got a lot to do with it. There is a lot of fear still that if you invest in a country whereby there's no political and or economic stability, that why would you get any return just from a business perspective? So that certainly had a huge bearing in the region, and I think that that's been something which, unlike Vietnam, which is, I guess, ahead and doesn't have that issue, then Pakistan hopefully in the future will be able to get past that.
Thank you. So we go right up the back and then we come down here.
Talk about two borders. What about the relationship with Iran? Would you like to outline why it is that Pakistan sees no problems at all with a neighbour that is arming itself to the teeth and being belligerent to everybody else in the region?
Not really, but I'll certainly try, David. I guess Pakistan also has its own people that it has to think about. And whilst I don't necessarily agree with the approach that Pakistan is taking, I certainly think that that is a very real fear for its own people on that particular border. Does that make that excusable? Probably not. But at the same time, it is a question of survival.
There's a question here.
Friend Neville Maxwell, who was a Times correspondent in India and was the author of a book on the border war in 65, taught at Oxford both Tony Abbott and, amusingly, Benazir Bhutto, and was a friend of Ali Bhutto. He tells me that there are key Pakistan families who own most of the country. Surely the fact that wealth is concentrated in a very small number of families makes the political development very difficult, and particularly when corruption, which you've not really alluded to, has tainted virtually everyone. Nawaz Sharif, Benazir's husband, the only person uncontaminated almost seems to be Pervez Musharraf.
Absolutely.
Well, I think our speaker said that.
Yes, I did say that.
You made the point.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I guess that's why I chose not to go down that path, because it's not been an issue as such in the last 12 months. Particularly under President Musharraf, there's been the National Accountability Bureau that was established, and certain members of not just the government but non-government are also asked to present if there are allegations of corruption. With your point in relation to the systemic failure of large families holding on to the entire wealth, well, I think that's an issue which is probably prevalent throughout the world. But at the same time, there is, I guess, a social responsibility that comes with wealth. And whether those families decide to take that on or not, I guess it's their choice. But I guess it is a systemic issue.
Anne.
Upstairs briefly, you may have already been asked about the bombing recently, the last couple of days.
The one
that Pakistan has sent the US for, but the US
yes.
Has praised Pakistan.
Yes, yes. I briefly mentioned
what's it. What's interesting is that there seems to be, is it cloak and dagger, are they all playing sort of shadow boxing, obviously the US has gone out and bombed some of the terrorist headquarters or wherever.
Yep.
They never seem to get anywhere. We never know whether they went anywhere after the bombing in Pakistan the other day.
Yep.
Pakistan condemned the US for unilateral action.
Yep.
But then George Bush congratulated or praised Pakistan.
Yep.
I mean, what's going on here? I mean, Pakistan is very dependent on the US.
Absolutely.
With the terrorists. So what's the complexity of all this, and what do you think really happened?
Well, we have a president that's on his way out in the United States, and we have a prime minister who's arrived in the United States from a politically unstable country at the moment. So in one sense, they're both on the back foot. The response of mutual, back padding, I don't think is going to achieve much for the moment. And if anything, as of, I think it was Friday last week, President Bush also announced that there was going to be funding that was going to be given to Pakistan instead of for counterterrorism, but to improve their F-16s. So, you know, Pakistan's approach has been, we don't want to get occupied by you guys, and US's approach has been, we'll give you funding, but just stop the extremists.
Stay tuned. Question here.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that there were certain voices that were asking for President Musharraf to return. What form do you think that return might take, and where are these voices coming from? Are they from within his own former party, or is it something new? Because you are correct, in his tenure there was stability, which has been lacking since the new government took place, but how do you see him coming back into the main group of politics?
Question about the nature of the forces that want President Musharraf to return.
I actually had a conversation with a current member of within politics, and he actually alluded to this particular fact. He says that people are starting to talk about it from the base level, not just from a political perspective, because the political parties are at the moment just infighting. They're actually not making decisions, and therefore they're just carrying on with what they want to achieve. As a result of that, people want stability in their lives. So whether it's business, whether it's industry, whether it's educators, when political instability occurs, and we don't get exposed to that, and we're very lucky that we don't get exposed to that, but, for example, school kids can't have their exams, or universities can't run their, final examinations, and it may take an extra year to finish your degrees or all those sorts of things. So, people want that sort of stability in their lives. So there potentially could be, I guess, a revolutionary movement as well, maybe from students, maybe from other social welfare groups. I'm not sure.
Yeah, hang on just a minute. Question here. Yep.
Yeah, just following on from that, I mean, how bad do you think it'll have to get before there's another coup, military coup?
The question is about the possibility of another military coup.
I hope it doesn't get any more worse. No, in all seriousness, it's the way I've had it described to me, because remember, in Pakistan right now, it's in the middle of summer, it's, 45, 50 degree dry heat before the monsoons hit, and there's no air conditioning, there's no electricity, school kids are on holidays. People, when you're hot and bothered as well, it doesn't really help that you're going to start blaming governments for not being able to, get your services. I forgot to mention before, actually, there's even obviously a food crisis, which is a worldwide issue at the moment. That too is affecting morale as well. So it could be as early as the next few months, or it could well be by the end of the year.
Question here.
Yes, I had an opportunity in the early 90s to travel in Pakistan, and part of this trip was traveling between Peshawar and the Khyber Pass. We were taken there and had things explained to us by a local tour guide. And from what he told us, it emerged that the government in Islamabad had very little control over that region. Now, in view of that, how can they really hope to control any movements between, let's say, of the Taliban or the Al-Qaeda between Afghanistan and the tribal regions?
Question about, there's a question about the extent to which the government in Islamabad controls regions beyond the capital, particularly in the Taliban areas. Yeah,
absolutely. And that's, I guess, what that federal belt and that's why the federal government has been involved in trying to control that belt with that zero tolerance policy. The other thing that obviously Pakistan has also been quite heavily involved in is working very, very closely with the CIA, with more than 10,000 both local and operatives from the United States in order to fight terrorism. Is that going to happen? Current trends are certainly showing that there's some control. What's the long-term policy in that region? I guess it's anybody's guess. It depends on how much economic power the Taliban and Al-Qaeda then get.
So just a clarification, if I may. 10,000 CIA agents on the ground in Pakistan?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Okay. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're from the United States, mm-hmm. but operatives within... Yes, absolutely.
Okay, we're getting right near the end, so I've missed a question right up the back. Yeah.
You said that it was a homogenous society. Does that mean that culturally, religiously, ethnically, there are relatively few issues within the population?
Oh, no, absolutely not. No, not at all. Let me clarify that. What I meant was, because Pakistan is an Islamic republic, it is... its rule of law and also its overriding governance is from an Islamic perspective, whereby it certainly does recognise other religions and cultures, but it is specifically an Islamic country as compared to India, which is a multicultural country from north to south in terms of dialects, in terms of even population, languages and definitely religion. That was the differentiation I was making.
Right up the back, make this the second last question up the back, yeah.
You mentioned suspension from the Commonwealth. Does that have any effect, any relevance? Does the Commonwealth have any sway?
Unfortunately, not really. Obviously, they've done it once before in the 8 years and then reinstated Pakistan, so it obviously needs to be a bit stronger for them to, you know, feel like that this is a real punishment.
Just a final question. Final question, as you mentioned, you were born in Pakistan, you're an Australian now. How do you see the relationship between our two countries? I mean, is there anything more that an Australian government should be doing? We've always had a lot of interest in Pakistan, but what should Australia be doing about the current crisis in Pakistan?
I think one of the most positive parts of Pakistani migration in Australia is that we've ended up with a group of people here who are from a relatively educated background, and they can certainly contribute in terms of coming up with policy. And Pakistan and Australia's relationship is a fairly good one, with BHP having a very strong interest in, for example, the gas industry in Pakistan, just to name one of the big companies. Generally speaking as well, having a good relationship. But yeah, I think that, you know, Pakistani Australians should be capitalised by the Australian government.
I would extra bit of that. The interesting thing about that is that the Pakistan immigrants to Britain have been obviously of a different kind, because the troublemakers tend to come from the Pakistani community, whereas here we don't, you know, Pakistanis have settled very well.
That's right.
Comparison between the Pakistani...
What's the difference? Are they coming from different places, or is it just that it's closer to get to Britain, so there's more?
Comparison between the Pakistani immigrants to Britain and the Pakistani immigrants to Australia.
Because there's been, you know, the Pakistani community here is a very peaceful set and is well settled group.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Huge migration policy differences. In the 60s and 70s, Britain opened open migration, whereby all socioeconomic groups were getting onto planes and going to Britain, whereas the migration which has been to Australia has, as I mentioned, been from people of educated and skilled background. That's made a huge difference, as you can see, with respect to people being able to integrate much better into society. Society as a whole.
Now, we could go a night, but we don't go a night. Stay there. There are a lot of people here, so I'll be very brief. Thanks to Wajah Ahmed. It was a great talk tonight. I learned a lot, and I think this is an issue we will return to. But the relationship between Australia and Pakistan is an important one. Pakistan is a most important country in the international scene. and just for you to come along tonight with your expertise and your recent visit to Pakistan and tell us what's happening in Pakistan has been most rewarding for all of us here. So congratulations, and I've no doubt with your, at your age and with your talent, you'll be back here in the future. But for tonight, well done. Thank you.